Welcome to the next episode of the Naked Truth of Startups. It's an international one, so we are talking English today. And I'm very happy to welcome our new guest in a second. But first of all, thanks to all the listeners from the last episodes. We had an amazing January with records of views and records of listeners. So that was amazing. Thanks to everybody. And keep going, keep on liking, following, and sharing. We are happy that you like it and that you have a topic where you can, or a podcast where you can learn something that you maybe don't learn anywhere else. And we are looking forward to today's episode. I am your host, as always, Alex, and I'm very happy to welcome Ryan Gutermann from Faraday in our podcast today. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you again. We know each other since 1.5 years. Your startup, Faraday, and you have been to our acceleration program and the Excite Lab in Dresden. For everybody who doesn't know this thing, we do acceleration for hardware startups, mostly hardware startups, when it comes to semiconductors, robotics, sensors, IoT, etc., and help startups to grow their network, maybe get some good industry partners and help them with some input from our experience of founding companies. And you have been in our first class. Since then, a lot of things happened. But before we talk about those things, maybe you can give us a short introduction about you and how you founded Faraday and what you're actually doing with Faraday.
I'm the CEO and founder of Faraday Sensors. And what we do is miniaturized gas sensors for a new generation of devices. This includes from IoT to logistics and packaging, smart sensors, and wearables. And our first product is Faraday Ox. It's the world's first oxygen sensor from the semiconductor industry. I think today when we think about sensors, you think about the semiconductor industry, but that wasn't always the case. The 20th century is full of sensors that are not from the semiconductor industry. They were large, expensive, usually used in niche industrial applications. But we've seen in the past 35 years, the semiconductor industry has been able to offer sensors that have similar, if not better, performance than their non-semiconductor counterparts, but at a fraction of the cost. And we're doing the same thing for gas sensing, starting with oxygen as our first product.
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw your first time the product, because like always, you never think about it if you don't hear about a thing and the signal. The sensors, I never thought about it, and then got the explanation, okay, how big they are normally, how expensive they are normally, and then seeing your sensor, like tiny, 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 tiny version of a sensor and on a chip. I mean, everybody who ever thought about it and ever looked up the process, how a chip is produced, how complicated it is, it's amazing. And then building on top a device or within a device, that's totally crazy. So how did you came up with the idea? Maybe you can tell us a little bit from your background.
Sure. So I didn't come up with the idea myself. This is actually my co-founder and CTO, Alexey Yakushenko, who came up with this idea. My background's in chemistry and material science, and he is also a chemist with some semiconductor and electrochemistry background. I'd say we both had parallel research careers. He studied in Israel and in Germany, became a department head at Fraunhofer, and I was a chemist. I'm from Canada, but chemist, a PhD, did my PhD in Canada, and then moved to Germany to run a group at Max Planck. And so we both had these identical, almost research streams. But he tried to build these miniaturized oxygen sensors in the past, but he realized that there was a material science component needed to make it possible. And when we look at the semiconductor industry, a lot of chemistry is used there. And a lot of it is actually legacy chemistry from the 20th century that was developed, allows certain processes to happen. For example, a photoresist is the most classic example. On one side, the semiconductor guys needed polymer materials that are patternable using light, and the chemists solved that problem. The same sort of thing happened here with Alexei, that he needed a type of material to satisfy the requirements for a microfabricated electrochemical sensor, which is the technology we're using, electrochemistry, but the materials needed to do that had not yet been invented. So it's a classic example of the microfabrication semicon industry needing the chemist to solve a specific material problem. It just so happened to be that my background was specifically on that topic, at least 80% of that topic. So I'd already had, you know, almost 10 years of a research career making those materials for electrochemical devices. We improved the performance of batteries, fuel cells, electrolyzers, and even some sensors. So when he came to me, I thought, okay, well, we can definitely, thing led to the other. We both wanted a change in our careers. So we founded Faradaic in 2021, applied for some fundamental patents, and then basically have raised money since then to build the product.
Nice. So that's one of the first truths about startups. There's always a portion of luck. So you have to meet the right persons at the right time, and have the just the luck, the coincidence that you have, that you meet.
Absolutely.
So, and then, but you didn't know each other before, right?
No, he reached out cold through an email. I still have that email because it was so on the nose with my career. Out of the blue, he was looking for collaborators.
Okay. And then, that's maybe one of the first questions that I think is very interesting. You didn't know each other before, and then you started a new company together, and we sometimes say it's building a company together is more, how to say, it's more commitment than a marriage. So how did you build up a team in the beginning? Two strangers starting with the idea. Maybe what did you do good to work together as a team?
Well, I think first of all, it just so happened to be that his family life story and my family life story had some overlap. So there was already a topic to discuss right from day one. That definitely helped. If it's, of course, two random people with zero connection, then yes, I don't know, maybe it would have gone down the same path or not. I don't know. But I think that familiarity from day one opened up the opportunity for a much more accelerated trust building process. Yeah. So because he understood a bit more about me and my background, I understood his background, the historical circumstances that led to our existence, even, you know, this type of thing. So already at that point, we were on the same page. That's the first part. The second part was I highly respect him as a scientist, as a person. He's hyper intelligent. And I think hopefully he thinks similarly of me, maybe not the same, but, you know, at least respect. So the respect element comes next, because I could see how good he was at what he does, also in his personal life, his work ethic. And then at that point, it's just about working together and finding each other's rhythm. And that's, of course, a process. And I know investors that don't invest in companies where the founders haven't known each other for at least a year, or work together previously, something like that, because that's usually the number one reason why a startup fails is the founders don't get along. So, the first year we always try and find each other's footing, and work together, but I'd say it's been, very good since then. We work together well as a team.
That's nice. I think you said it already. It's for many VCs, always the topic. Okay. What is the team? What is the founding team? Do they trust each other? How long do they work together? Is there any risk of that they don't get along anymore or whatever? So that's super important. Okay, so then maybe just give us a short story about how did it work since 2021 when you founded the company until today? Maybe how many people you hired and how many money you raised, stuff like that.
In 2021, this was still in the COVID era, so a lot of things were still remote. I had left Max Planck to formulate how to build this company. I had to become, you know, familiar with, you know, German corporate law and all this type of stuff. So there's a bit of a learning curve there for sure. I also started a different company at the time. I actually had a company before, so this is my third GmbH, or I guess one was a UG, but there are other stories. But I had two companies at the same time with Faradaic, and whichever one I felt was going to succeed more, I would devote more resources. So Faradaic was the one. Yeah, 2021 founded, applied for some patents, because that's really the first thing we needed to do to protect the IP, because we couldn't talk about anything unless we submitted patents. And then we raised a little bit of angel capital, and then got into some Berlin programs that really helped us network and get a lab space. We were, of course, pinching pennies at that point. The real big break was in late 2022 when we got notification that we got the EIC accelerator. So that's $2.5 million non-dilutive capital. We had also raised some money on our own, some cash from other investors. This was enough to basically go from our proof of idea, proof of, not even proof of concept, proof of principle stage. We didn't have a POC at that stage. Yeah. Proof of principle to actually proving that, hey, all of this works and we can take this to the next level in terms of scalability and performance. At that point, we raised a little bit more, but early 2025, we raised our seed round led by Join Capital in located in Berlin. We got the EIC on board as shareholders. We have investors from Singapore, from the US, selling commercial products. So we are a commercially active semiconductor company. We have successfully built our oxygen sensors. We have clients all over the world. We have clients including semiconductor companies, food packaging, even some wearable companies as well. So all these companies need oxygen sensors for a similar purpose, that is measure oxygen concentrations in their application. And the volume requirements are pretty high. Only a semiconductor solution can really take this to the moon. And so that's really our goal, to help our partners realize their vision of building the types of products that they see that allows them to have an edge in the market. Basically, with access to our tech, they can do things nobody in the world can. And we're here to support them with that. And of course, expand the technology platform to other gases and applications as well.
Nice. Thanks. So there's the first thing that really comes to my mind, something that we see a lot with especially younger startups or very early startups. And we work a lot together with the university. So we also see those research groups that have ideas. And then they think by themselves, okay, we need to build something that we can sell it or that we can raise money for it. And that was an interesting thing you mentioned, that you raised money from angels, from different investors. You got the accelerator without having a product. What is your learning when you look back at this time? I mean, or how did you make the decision that you go out that early to get money?
Well, I didn't give a proper shout out to actually an institution that helped us get here. That is the Alchemist Accelerator, located in San Francisco, because we were part of their program in 2022. And a lot of what we've learned is through them. We have some of our investors we met through there. The organization is phenomenal. Ravi, who runs it, is a prolific individual. And one of our investors said it really well. What is it that an investor wants? They want the biggest return in the shortest amount of time with the least amount of risk. Yeah. So if you can frame your business in that way, then you can have success. Now, it's very hard to do all three at once. You know, for example, software companies, you know, speed is there, but risk is high because anyone could just come in and build the same thing within, you know, especially with AI in an afternoon. The time element is always longer. So that's just a fundamental fact of deep tech. It will just be longer to get to market. You can raise maybe earlier and have big rounds, but you're only going to see the fruits of that labor could be 5 to 10 years, actually, maybe even longer for some companies. So you have to lean into your strengths. And in the world of semiconductors, there's really a couple of things you can lean into. And that is, if you have something very unique that comes from a very specific place that only a couple minds in the world know how to do, and what are the chances that they get together and build this venture? If you can lean into that side, you can actually decrease the risk portion. Say, look, it's going to take them time to build it, but no one else will be able to build it except for this team. So the time element is just maybe a matter of their internal process. Maybe, you know, maybe they have a policy that they need 5-year returns or 7 or 10. So that's a separate topic. But investors look at potential. And if you can show the big potential and the milestones to get there, you break it up into pieces and you de-risk it at every stage as much as possible. Then at that point, it just becomes of a risk reward balance. It's just like, well, how much should I give at what valuation to balance that risk? And I think that's the way to think about raising in deep tech. With software, you really need money from day one, cash coming in, because the barrier to entry is so low that if you're not making money from day one, well, then maybe you just don't have a business. Deep tech usually takes a different approach where the problems are big. Everyone knows that if you can build it, you'll make money. It's just really hard to do. So you have to then lean into your team, your personal background, your network, your connections, your accomplishments, the technology that you have, and that de-risks that portion. That was what I learned through Alchemist, especially. They were very good at that.
Yeah, very nice. We will connect them in the show notes so that the others can also look at them. Sounds very good. Just one, I think we will turn off the video. The internet connection is not that good, so that we can have a better audio. Yeah,
sure.
I will just turn it off, right? Okay. Okay, so you mentioned one thing with the problem needs to be big enough. And I think that's also a very interesting point. How did you challenge, or how did you figure out what actually the market is and how big it is?
Yes, this was something that first came from my co-founder and the company that he had built previously and the market he was entering, which was actually food packaging, because it's a very high volume market, cost sensitive, but high volume. The way that we viewed the market was that there are an absurd number of applications where you need an oxygen sensor being used today and where our clients want this technology to go. The big problem was just where to start. That was always the topic that we had to really figure out. And we call it the tip of the spear. What is the tip of the spear for the company in this market? Because we knew already, if we build this sensor at the right price point and performance, we'll sell it. We'll sell it for all sorts of applications all over the world. But to do that takes a lot of cash. And like I said, you need these milestones that allows you to de-risk the firm so that you can raise capital at better valuations and keep the train running. So that was where the topic was. And at the beginning, we saw a few opportunities. I mean, respiratory is huge, especially in medical, you know, high volumes, willingness to pay. Yeah. Food became a topic that continued to develop from even when we founded the company. And then other applications like in semiconductors, which was a little bit more new for us, one that we're actually pursuing, right? Basically assets that are packaged under low oxygen. This could be a food or a semiconductor or electronic. Monitoring it actually is proven to be a value for our clients. And only a technology like ours can really do this in the ways that they want it to be done in terms of price and scale and performance. So that was where the topic was. And of course, trying to get market sizing information, you really need to do your homework. We typically try and take a bottom-up approach rather than top-down, simply because it's a bit more informed. So of course, speaking to clients, understanding their markets, and then building from there. That's essentially how we've done it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's also a very good point to understand what your customer can earn with your product you have. Something that we always get as a feedback when we talk with our partners, industry partners, talking about startups, and they say the startups come up with nice technology, but they have no clue how we can earn money with that. So there's a differentiator when you come up with an idea and you can tell them how they can earn money with it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I think the deep tech people can always learn from the SaaS people, and that is SaaS people are usually very good at identifying problems in the world and being hyper-specific with their solution. The problem with deep tech is that quite often the world doesn't even know that there is that problem. I mean, you know, does the world know that they need the internet? I don't think anyone thought that we needed internet. We could have lived perfectly fine without the internet like we had for the past 300,000 years. But once we have it, we realize it's important. So deep tech companies often have that problem to overcome. Doesn't mean there's no value. It just means that there's just a protracted period before that value can be realized.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so you to build your company, you need strong partners or companies like chip manufacturers like Infineon or ESMC or whatever. Now, coming up from as a researcher with a little startup, how did you approach those companies?
We approached them through our network, so people that we knew who had connections there. And the feedback was always interesting. Sounds great. Come back when you have your first prototypes or first product or first wafer up the line. obviously not the answer you want to hear when you're starting out, because you feel that you have a direction and an energy that can provide value to these companies, yep, and that their support can actually accelerate. But it was also helpful to understand what their requirements were, you know, because again, they have to weigh the risk as well. And to essentially do the homework on our side to make sure that we can address it. But really, network is number one. If you know, warm introductions, industry experts. This is why joining programs like Excite Lab and anything similar to that even is really important. It gives you those door openers.
Definitely, we can only recommend. But it's also, I mean, it's difficult from time to time. But how did you choose which accelerators or programs you join? Because I mean, sometimes you know it before because of recommendation. You don't know it, just assuming. Or do you have any criteria where you say, okay, look at this or look at that before joining a program?
First of all, I will see what the cost of the program is and what it provides, either in a monetary value or in kind value. So I think there's a transactional element there. Is who's supporting it? You know, often there are a bunch of logos present, and you think, oh, okay, there's that logo there. There must be a connection, and usually a person who's responsible for making connections. So that's also important. You know, the engineer is not responsible for connecting startups with management. There's usually someone responsible for that, and the programs who are involved with those companies actually know who that person is. So that's very important. And the next, I think this is something very important for any early deep tech company to consider. There are a lot of programs out there that will cater to startup, but what they really mean is software. And this is actually something you have to really be aware of, is that anything that caters to software is likely not relevant to you as a deep tech company. Not saying always, but most of the time. Just everything is different. The expectations are different. The people are different. You know, you're not going to talk to scientists very much. You're not going to talk to, you know, manufacturing experts very much. So I'd say that's the first level. And that is, if you're a deep tech company and we're in the semiconductor industry, do you cater to semicon? If the answer is no, then chances are the program's not for us. So we really try and we believe that being specific is important. And if you try and do everything as a program, then you typically fall short across the board.
And how many programs did you took part over the years now?
Probably like six or so. You know, to different levels. Some are very, very short, others a little bit longer. So yeah, six at least. You know, we're still, of course, interested in joining more because as the company grows, our requirements change. And so there are programs catered for every stage. Up until, you know, Series B, Series C even. And really even beyond that, I think it's always valuable to join a program, particularly because of the networks that you obtain, that you get access to through the program.
Yeah, network in Germany, you always say vitamin B. So it's the vitamin for making connections. So vitamin B. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so then you already mentioned it before. You started at least two companies before. I had even one in parallel to Faraday. So you're now an experienced founder. What are the things that you say, okay, that's the thing where the most painful or the most enjoyable things? Is there anything you can say? What is the most interesting experience, maybe things like that?
I would say that some of the biggest mistakes that early founders, including myself, have made, especially in my early companies, no founder or nobody on the cap table except for an investor at founding should not be subjected to vesting of their shares. An investor is different. They put cash in. Those are their shares, unless they have another portion of shares for actually doing work, which can be subjected to vesting. But from day one, everyone needs to vest. A lot of people don't like that. And I think especially minority founders might feel that, maybe I'll take a step back. Always have three, never have two, and absolutely don't have one founder. So I think solo founders, especially in deep tech, where you just need a lot of expertise, is a big red flag. if you can't convince that person to join you in your company, what, you know, are investors going to invest? Can you expect an investor to join? The answer is probably not. You know, you have bad days, you need a co-founder to help out, that kind of thing. And have three, so you have a deal breaker. And then have vesting. So if someone starts to screw off and waste the company's time, you have a means of getting them out and getting the shares back, and you can always, you know, bring in a new founder. I think people operate based on trust, which is great, but you need to have some teeth in the documentation. Luckily, it has never caused big issues in my companies that I've founded, but I have seen it time and time again be a huge problem in early stage companies where everything is on the line. Yes. And they just didn't put the documentation in properly. So, no.
Yeah, very good point. And I think something people are maybe sometimes afraid of to talk about or to bring it into the game, because they maybe think, oh, then the other things, other people think that you don't trust them or that you want to betray them or whatever. But at the end, it is what you said. You never know what's coming. You maybe start a company with somebody you don't know for that long. And if you go into the risk to starting it and you are the one who started it, then it's, I think, fair to have kind of a vesting in there.
I would give people the benefit of the doubt to start with, especially new founders who don't understand that this is actually expected and normal. Once they learn that this is actually expected and normal, this is my warning to all young founders, if you're trying to start a company and someone keeps fighting back on putting investing clauses from day one, do not start the company with this person.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I always said it during my times as the chief people and culture officer for the company, for my last company, that it was interesting because I always said to the people, listen carefully what people start to discuss about in the interviews or in the early beginnings of talking to someone when you want to hire him. When they immediately come to you, all the regulation, all the tiny little details of a potential contract or whatever it is, I was always in my inner mind, always went a step back. Like, okay, what is, something is off here. Something is not right. It doesn't feel right. And I think that's also something, believe in your gut feelings, in your intuition, that if it doesn't feel right, maybe don't do it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, gut feeling is very important as well in this world. You meet a lot of people, your gut is usually a good indication.
Yeah. Yeah, do you know the beer and puppet test?
No, what's this?
I don't know where I read it, but I read it some days ago again. It was like, okay, if you meet somebody and you want to make business with them, or you want to start a company or whatever with them, or I don't know, then ask yourself, would you go for two beers with the person? I mean, you can go for one beer with everybody more or less, but would you take another beer, a second beer in the same evening? Well, if you take the second beer, it's maybe a good thing. And would you leave your puppet at this person?
What do you mean by puppet? So,
yeah, a little dog or a cat puppet.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, these are, yeah, that's a trust building aspect. It's a personal connection and trust. Yeah. That's what you're testing.
Yep. So, and it comes to the topic. I mean, you started the company. Why did you actually start it in Germany and not in San Francisco or many deep tech companies are doing it in the US?
Do you mean, just so I'm clear with your question, do you mean why we didn't have the Hauptsitz of the company in the US, but activities in Germany, or even just have activities in, you know, leave Germany?
No, why you have your headquarters here?
Well, we were here to begin with, and it just made sense to have, you know, to do everything locally. We do know that there are certain funding opportunities that are more difficult to access if you're foreign. That's and in the end it proved to be correct. I mean, we got a lot of great funding being a German company. I know other companies that, you know, started out in the US or have made the flip. I think there are multiple ways to do this. There isn't a single way to approach this. We just made a decision early on. Look, we're all in Germany. Might as well start a company here. In the end, I think, in the end, both are good options. There isn't a single option that, especially nowadays, I think in 10 years ago, it would have been very hard for investors from the US to come to Germany. Today, I think it's actually quite a bit different. I think it's becoming a lot smoother. So I think the problem is less large as it used to be.
Yeah, definitely. 10 years ago, it was a different story. That's true.
Yes.
Okay. But then, I mean, building up the company means you need to find people, you need to hire people, you need to build up a team. So how did you manage to bring in the right people? How big is the team now?
We're about 21 people altogether.
Okay. So how did you find those people? Any tricks you can share? Any secrets?
Well, it always starts with your network. I keep coming back to that, but we knew very early on that we had to build a chemistry team that does synthetic chemistry and an electrochemistry team. I had a network of chemists who could do the job, and our first hire actually was a chemist through my network of professors and researchers from the academic world. He's still with the company, and he's a fantastic chemist, fantastic person. And that was the starting point, just really that for those personal connections. The next is location. There are really only a few countries in the world that can do real synthetic chemistry. Germany,
okay.
US, Japan, Canada, and I think increasingly so China, but depends on what you're talking about. These are like the powerhouses of synthetic chemistry. Russia as well, by the way, only because they have nothing and they have to do everything themselves. It builds very, very capable synthetic chemists. We call them the Navy SEALs of science because they're the most battle-hardened scientists I think I've ever met. These are people who put in 20-hour days. There are jokes that overnight is 4 hours. If you do a reaction, chemical reaction overnight, usually you write 4 hours. So your skill as a synthetic chemist is judged by how many lab books you've gone through. Not by how many papers, not by your successes even, but by your failures and the sheer work you've put in. That's your measure of success as a chemist. So there's only a few countries that you could actually do chemistry in, I think, effectively. So Germany made sense. One of the top three in the world, maybe even number one, you could argue. For electrochemistry, it's a little bit different. You can actually go to other countries. And so my co-founder understood that there are many places in the world where you can find really good electrochemists, physical chemists. And so we looked in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And so we have a lab in Serbia where we have a fantastic team of physical chemists and electrochemists who essentially do that side of the business and that side of the technology. So it's a combination of location. And once you're in the right location, the people are there, you know, make the job postings, meet people. But, you know, you're not going to find a skier in Saudi Arabia. So don't go there if you're looking for skiers, you know, maybe go to Finland or Canada or something, right? So you really need to start with location.
It makes sense. Okay, but it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like a more difficult story than I expected what you're telling, because that actually means you start a company in Germany, you build up another part in a different country, which always is more hassle when it comes to bookkeeping, regulations, whatever, legal tech, legal things, stuff like that. Then you said, okay, where's the market? Where are the experts? So I assume you come around along a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we have to do. I know there are many ways to do this. I think there isn't a single way to go about it. I know a lot of companies that are just fully centralized, and I think nothing wrong with that. That's an easier way to do things, as everything is consolidated. But then you leave some things on the table as well. So having a couple locations takes advantage of what every area has to offer. If you need good electrochemists, you're going to find them in certain places. If you need good synthetic chemists, well, there are only so many options. So try and leverage that as best as you can.
Yep. So maybe more a private question, but being a founder, especially when with successful companies where it speeds up quickly, like in your case, Owen also did. I mean, coming from two people to now 21 people, you got a lot of money on founding or partners that buy your products. You have to deliver things. Maybe any recommendations for founders, how to keep your work-life balance in a good balance?
Yeah, I think it depends always on personal circumstances. First, you need to believe in what you're doing. That way, the work is fulfilling. It will be difficult, but nonetheless fulfilling. I think important to have a good network, personal network around you. I'm married. I have a child. My wife supports me very, very, very much. My family as well, who believes in what I do. So I think that's actually very important. No one does this alone. And again, that's something from Alchemist Accelerator we learn, is that everyone gets help. And I think we have, the hero syndrome that exists in the world, that people think that everything happens because a single individual managed to do it. But the reality is that everyone has support, everyone has help. This is a marathon, it's not a sprint. So take your time, maybe not as much as you may want. You still need to push with impetus and urgency. But there's a long game here, and you need to take care of yourself and your own well-being. And that starts with your network and family. So if you don't have your network and family, personal network and family in order, I would say don't go down this road. It's not a good idea, really. You really need things in order personally to do this. And if your things are in order personally, financially as well, by the way, not just emotionally, this becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing you mentioned. It always sounds, or it looks from the outside in many cases, even if there's already a big founding going on and stuff like that, it can be still tough times, financially tough times, for the founders or for the employees, even the early employees in the company. Because, I mean, money flows not into the salaries and huge cars and whatever. It flows into the product and building up the company, finding new people, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then you need to be convinced what you're doing. You need to have a good network and a backup, and at least thought it through. What does it actually mean when it takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Absolutely. And beyond that, in the company, it's important to hire people who you want to work with. I know that sounds a little obvious, but sometimes that gets blindsided by expertise and company requirements. I can safely say every single person in our company who we've hired are people I want to work with, who I learned from, who are exceptional at what they do. We definitely cannot reach our goals without the team that we have. But at the same time, this also applies to investors. You don't want an investor who makes your life horrible. You want investors who you can trust, who don't overburden you, but are there to support you. So the people element is key here. Surround yourself with people who you actually get along with, you want to work with, who you trust. Personal life and business life. And things just become a lot easier.
I can relate to your people, because I'm glad that I had the honor to meet some of your colleagues, and they are all really super nice and great people. So I can definitely sign this. Maybe one last question. So I'm just looking at the timing. One question, because you brought it up, finding the right investors. Anything you can give as a tip or secret, or how you did it, to how to select the right investor, especially when you talk about personal connection?
Yeah, that's a topic for an entire other podcast, I would say, another episode. It's interesting. This is not like selling a property where you have a transaction and both parties walk away and never see each other anymore. An investor invests in you as a person, especially at this stage. Eventually the finance guys come in with their tables and then you don't matter anymore. But for early stage and mid stage, it's really about and that's a relationship that takes time to build. You have to sit down, you chat, you have a beer, you do all that kind of understanding what other startups, from their portfolios say, I think is critical. If a startup cannot give a completely positive, exemplary example of why their investors are awesome, If they just say like milquetoast medium, things like, oh yeah, it's all right, it's terrible. So you need to speak to the portfolio companies, and I'd say relatively early. Say, hey, can you introduce me to a couple, founders from your portfolio? You know, most of the time investors are happy to do so, and they'll most likely cherry pick the ones that they want you to speak to, which is fine as well.
Yeah, of course.
And if they can't give a complete shining example of why they're amazing, be careful. You know, you need cash, so you have to deal with what you have on the table, but definitely prioritize from there and make sure the documentation is clear enough that you protect yourself, because yeah, that's something you can't avoid. You will need cash at some point. You may not get the best option, but you can at least know what who you're dealing with, and then make sure the documentation is written accordingly.
Very good points. Thanks. And I know, we could do a whole series, maybe a whole podcast just about the relationship from investors and startups, for sure. And there are a lot of good examples out there, and there are also a lot of bad examples out there. And I think something you mentioned is very important in the beginning when you more rely on the good network of the investors or on the feedback of the investors, of knowledge, etc., that you really pick the right ones. Even if, yes, you maybe not have all the best option on the table, but you need to figure out which one is the best of those you have on the table. It's not only about money. So that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Okay, Ryan, thanks. Thanks a lot until here. I'm just looking at the clock, and we want to finish in time. So thanks a lot for all the insights. Thanks a lot for sharing your story and your experience, and give us a little view behind the curtains. So that's very nice. And as I said in the beginning on our pre-talk, looking forward to have another series or another podcast with you when it comes to the exit. And I don't know, what's the plan in 5 years, 10 years, or will you keep going until, I don't know, you rule the world in chemistry and microelectronics?
Yeah, all good questions. The future is completely unknown. We have, of course, our goals set, and we're pragmatists. We make decisions based on what's in front of us and what we understand. I think, what would be the best case scenario? The best case is that I walk away happy, my co-founder walks away happy, my employees walk away happy, and my investors walk away happy. What that looks like, there are many opportunities, many options, but that's really the goal. We want all of us to walk away happy, also our partners and clients. The belief in science in general, you know, something that is implicit is that technology and scientific advancement should help everybody. There's, of course, a mechanism of, you know, value generation and capturing value and benefiting from it.
Yep.
Yes, that those are just mechanisms behind the scene, but innovations should help everyone. And if our innovation can help everyone, and that everyone who built that technology can walk away happy, I think that's really all I can ask for. Whether that's an IPO or an M&A or something, I think that remains to be seen.
I think it was a wonderful description. I have nothing to add there. So thank you again, Ryan, for your time here. But you also are not allowed to leave without answering our typical three questions at the end. So the first one is always without which tools you can't work. Maybe you have three.
Yeah, I would say we use Slack a lot. That's a tool that I think has become a standard for communication. So that's definitely one over there. I would say, being a non-native speaker, translation tools has been very, just to understand some very complex German that even, you know, your local German doesn't even understand. So that has been very helpful as well. And as a third, great question. I mean, of course, AI tools have come up as being very useful. So I don't think I can't not mention that. It has definitely changed the way that we do research, that we ask questions and try to obtain some answers. I think everyone feels that they don't take advantage of it to the max. You know, there's always opportunity and potential. I think the stock market agrees there too. So I think that's an exciting journey to explore as well.
Is there any AI tool that you especially use as a researcher?
Well, as when I was doing research, there was no AI. So, my CTO would be better to answer on that question. But okay. I think scheduling tools with AI has become a lot more convenient, because before everything was manual. Now there's a lot of automation behind scheduling and taking notes and planning. All that has become a lot easier.
Okay, nice. Then what did you bought recently for less than €100 that you need to share with us?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's more, maybe not a single item, but recurring items. I like to buy good food, good quality food. Of course, food items cost less than 100. It could be, that exotic fruit from halfway across the planet. It could be the best quality meat that you can find. For me, this is something I feel that if I'm not doing, I'm not living my potential. That's something that it's more on the personal side, because if I feel I'm eating the best food I can, I'll perform the best I can, I'll feel the best I can, and also I enjoy the flavor. So I'd say don't skip out on good food. It always costs less than 100, that's for sure, and the quality of life just goes up.
Yes, that's definitely, that's 100% correct. Okay, and then the last question is, what is the book you recommend the most, or maybe give away?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. I think for deep tech founders, especially technical ones, there's a book called How to Pitch Anything. I come from a background of like a lot of presentations and pitching. It's something in Canada and the US that even scientists practice specifically as part of their education. Maybe not explicitly in undergrad, but definitely in PhD, you're expected to give a killer presentation. In Europe, I don't find that to be the case. I find that a lot of presenters abuse my time with their really garbage talks. Founders eventually catch their footing and they get better and such. Yes, not always, but I'd say 90% of the time it gets there. So I'd recommend that. It gets you into the psychology of giving a presentation. It's all about following instructions. It's not magic. It's not, you have a feel for it or not. You could just follow a formula and practice it and become really good. And without that skill, everything becomes difficult, from sales to fundraising. So I would recommend that.
That's a very good recommendation. And I can also just cite what you said about the European or German researchers and their presentations. They're difficult from time to time.
Yeah, but we're here to help, though.
So. Yeah, very nice. So, okay, thanks. Then, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I hope you liked it as well. And for everybody out there who has any questions about Faraday, to you, Ryan, whatever, we will put, of course, the homepage and the LinkedIn profile in the show notes, so we can reach out to you or to me, and I will forward it. And I think we managed it in time. Thanks a lot for your time again, Ryan.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And I wish you and your team all the best for the future. Looking forward to have another interview in some years. Whatever happens, just to give an update and see how you manage it to grow and build up this company. All the best to you. Okay, and yes, to all the listeners out there, thanks for listening to the podcast. Hope we managed to find some good points that were interesting for you, maybe we could learn something from. Looking forward to see your comments, your questions. Don't forget to like and to follow, as always, and recommend to other people so that more people can learn what it means to build up a company. And we have hopefully more founders that build up successfully companies. Yeah, that's it for today. I say, have a great day to everybody, and hear you next time. Bye-bye.